on to the next case of the morning, which is Reginald Wiley versus City of Chicago. Mr. Blackman.
May it please the court. The principal dispute in this appeal is between the parties as to what plaintiff's claims are. The city says this is a claim about a false arrest, whether when Mr. Jones saw Mr. Wiley out on the street, he had a reasonable basis to stop him. We think that isn't what our case is. We say that after Mr. Jones stopped Mr. Wiley, found that Mr. Wiley was not committing any crime, was not in possession of any contraband, that Mr. Jones planted drugs on Mr. Wiley, that he framed him. And then after he framed him, he brought him to the police station, that he wrote up a false police report, that relying on that false police report, a judge made a finding of probable cause to detain. That as a result of that, Mr. Wiley was held in custody until he had a preliminary hearing. At the preliminary hearing, the officer testified. The judge said, no probable cause. Thereafter, the prosecutor went to the grand jury, who, relying again on Mr. Jones, the officer, and his frame-up, said, we're going to indict this man. And then Mr. Wiley continued to be subject to significant restraints. While his criminal case pended, he was not able to leave the state of Illinois. He was free on bond. He was not able to leave the state of Illinois. He had to come to court all the time, and there were other restrictions on his freedom of movement and his freedom of activity. And then finally, in July, there was a trial. Mr. Jones testified again. The judge said, not guilty. And then we filed the lawsuit. The city says, you should have filed the lawsuit 2 years after the original stop on the street, because that's all you could complain about in this case. Everything else is... You got to sue him in state court or something. And we're not suing about the initial stop. We're suing about the frame-up. And the case that we cited that was decided by the court, I think, less than 2 weeks ago, Gallagher versus Hendel says, as I think the city...
Let me just make something clear. Forgive me. But you are claiming malicious prosecution, are you not?
No, we are not, Your Honor. Malicious prosecution requires proof that the officer, Mr. Jones, caused the prosecution. It's very conceivable and probably likely that this case went on automatic pilot, that Mr. Jones didn't go and exhort the prosecutor to file charges. The prosecutor looked at the report, said, well, Mr. Wiley has a criminal history, and we don't like the judge. He said, no probable cause. We're going to teach him the lesson. We're going to get an indictment.
Okay, so that's out of game.
And as we said that in the district court, when the city moved to dismiss the malicious prosecution claim, we said, we don't have a malicious prosecution claim. This is a 1983 action. And actually, if we want to analyze the constitutional violations, I think it's a Fourth Amendment case. I think that the Fourth Amendment requires a judicial determination of probable cause within 48 hours after arrest, unless there's some reason. That's the Gerstein ruling.
But there's no rule that they can't take the matter directly to the grand jury with or without the probable cause finding.
That's correct. In this case, though, the judge made a... No, it has, if the man is being held in custody...
No, if the examining magistrate says no probable cause, that doesn't prevent the prosecution presenting the matter and getting
it. Absolutely not. But Your Honor is skipping over the Gerstein hearing. The judge in Circuit Court of Cook County, within 48 hours of the arrest, a judge looks at the police report and says probable cause to detain. That finding was corrupted by the false report that Mr. Jones prepared. Thereafter, I think like a month after, there was a preliminary hearing. Mr. Wiley stayed in custody for the preliminary hearing, and the judge said no probable cause, and he was released.
There's no Fourth Amendment is a seizure, then? This is what we're dealing with?
Well, there certainly was. The Fourth Amendment was violated by the corrupt Gerstein hearing. That's the same as when a police officer goes and gets a warrant by lying about it. That's a Fourth Amendment violation. Here, a judge made a finding of probable cause to detain because the officer lied about what happened. That should be a Fourth Amendment violation. The Fourth Amendment violation ended when the judge, at the preliminary hearing, said no probable cause and Mr. Wiley was released.
So how does Gallagher affect your arguments about the Fourth Amendment?
Gallagher says that under Heck versus Humphrey, when you're complaining about this kind of issue, when there's a frame-up case, as in Okoro, that case doesn't accrue until the criminal case is resolved in your favor. That's a black-letter rule that's now appeared in, I think, four cases in the circuit, which is what our claim is, that he was framed. If we want to analyze this in the Fourth Amendment thing, I would say that there was another Fourth Amendment violation when the grand jury, based on the bogus evidence of frame-up, had probable cause to indict. And I would say that Fourth Amendment violation continued while Mr. Wiley was subject to those restraints until the judge said not guilty. But this is really a case that could be resolved in a two-line opinion, that the order dismissing the case is reversed under Gallagher, and that should be the end of this case. The city wants this case to be a vehicle for the circuit to reassess its entire jurisprudence. That's not presented in this case. This is a frame-up case. This isn't a case where there's an arrest and after, and the arrest turns up evidence of guilt. This is a case where there's an arrest, there's no evidence of guilt, and the cops manufacture evidence of guilt, and then lie about it. Thank you.
Hey, thanks. Mr. Rosenthal? May it please the court.
Mr. Rosenthal, just straight out, would you concede that Wiley's Fourth Amendment false arrest claim is timely if we follow the law that was set forth in Gallagher?
Yes. And not timely if you follow Booker. And not timely if you follow Gonzalez. And not timely if you follow Washington. I have two answers to all questions, depending on which kind of cases you're looking at. Mr. Wiley presses two theories, one based on the Fourth Amendment and one based on the Due Process Clause. There are two problems with his due process theory. The first is, this court has held, the availability of a state tort malicious prosecution action gives him all the process that's due, and although I hold Mr. Flaxman in considerable regard, he's just not being accurate when he says he didn't bring a malicious prosecution claim. His complaint expressly pleads the state tort of malicious prosecution.
Of course, he didn't appeal the judge's findings in that regard here.
He had nothing to appeal. The judge refused to exercise supplemental jurisdiction over that claim.
Well,
that wasn't an abuse of discretion.
Well, he could have, he could have brought that
in state court, and he can bring it in state court today, which is all the process that's due. And so, but I do suggest that he ought to be estopped to claim that he has no state tort remedy here when he pled a state tort remedy and he didn't get that claim dismissed with prejudice. He still can refile.
You know, you argued in your petition for hearing en banc that Gallagher is irreconcilable with our earlier ruling. Of course, Judge Posner made it pretty clear in Gallagher that he was, that the panel wasn't overruling those cases. It characterized the conflicting parts of those cases as dicta. Was the Gallagher panel wrong when it characterized the language in those other cases as dicta?
Yes, with all due respect, and I know I'm one member of the panel staring at me here just a minute ago, but with all due respect, Booker expressly acknowledges the concession in that case was critical to the prosecution, couldn't go forward
with that. You think Judge Posner just didn't want to hurt the feelings of the other panel members?
Perhaps so.
That's
perhaps
it.
So, Judge Rose. And Gonzalez versus Entrest, Your Honor, joined Gonzalez versus Entrest. There, Judge Easterbrook expressly acknowledges the whole prosecution against Gonzalez hinged on the testimony of a single witness, Hernandez, and yet he said Gonzalez didn't need to get Hernandez's testimony suppressed to bring that claim until Gallagher No opinion of this circuit had ever said that the quantum or the character of the evidence at issue governs the accrual issue, whether it's crucial or critical or whether there's factual inconsistency. But in light of what we regard as the conflicting precedent in this circuit, we begin, if we could, with Heck versus Humphrey itself, putting aside all the precedent. Reasoning from Heck, Heck's holding is actually very straightforward. It doesn't talk about whether there's factual inconsistency between the civil rights action and the state court prosecution. It doesn't talk about the quantum or the character of evidence. It goes to common law accrual rule. And that's what it relies on. The Supreme Court points out in Heck, the common law, in effect, when that Section 1983 was enacted by Congress in 1871, drew a distinction between malicious prosecution claims, which did not accrue until the prosecution terminated, and false arrest claims, which accrued immediately upon arrest. And if I could, permit me to read just a sentence from the Heck opinion. The common law cause of action for malicious prosecution provides the closest analogy to claims of the type considered here, because unlike the related cause of action for false arrest or confinement, it permits damages for confinement imposed pursuant to legal process. In short, Heck draws the distinction between false arrest claims, your damages before any legal process issues, before charges are filed, and a malicious prosecution claim, which seeks damages for the actual prosecution, date on which charges are filed forward. This, of course, is a false arrest claim. It is explicitly premised upon Mr. Wiley's arrest, allegedly without probable cause. Now, we quite agree, even apart from Mr. Wiley's state tort remedy, had Mr. Wiley timely brought suit, he could have obtained a remedy for his false arrest prior to the time the charges were filed. But there is a central inconsistency in the Garber opinion itself, which is why we do not believe it can be reconciled with Heck. Garber cuts off damages on the claim, the Fourth Amendment claim it recognizes, the time charges are filed. Mr. Garber, in that case, only gets damages for about 8 hours of confinement prior to the time he's charged. But that, under Heck, is clearly a false arrest claim. It's not seeking damages for the course of the prosecution, the years that Mr. Garber spent on death row. It's only seeking damages for the period of time that Mr. Garber was in the custody of the police before he was charged. And Heck, whatever the ambiguities in footnote 7, and there's been a lot of fighting in the circuits about footnote 7 of Heck, and they've split essentially 3-3 with this circuit at different times expressing different positions on what footnote 7 of Heck means. We suggest put footnote 7 aside and look at the reasoning of Heck, because the distinction that Heck draws between false arrest claims and malicious prosecution claims governs here. The very cause of action that Garber recognized, and Mr. Flaxman rests on today when he rests on Garber and urges this court to write a two-sentence opinion based on Garber. The only cause of action that Garber recognizes is for custody prior to the time charges are filed. That, at common law, was a false arrest action. It accrued immediately. The accrual rule that Congress would have adopted when it enacted the Civil Rights Act of 1871, in short, meant that this kind of claim should be brought immediately, if there's any. And for that reason, simply relying on the distinction Heck itself draws, rooted in the common law, not rooted in whether there's factual inconsistency between the federal civil rights claim and the state prosecution, not rooted in the type of evidence that's going to be introduced in state court, the distinction Heck draws is rooted in the common law of accrual. Aside from that, as we also point out in our petition, the rule that Garber embraces is wholly unworkable because it makes a cruel turn on what evidence is actually adduced at trial, whether the evidence that's placed at issue by the Fourth Amendment claim is critical. Of course, people who have been arrested and facing trial, they can't tell if their Fourth Amendment claim has been accrued. In some cases, like Mr. Wiley, perhaps he could tell. But in other cases where the defendant won't know what evidence is introduced against him, he has no way of knowing whether his cause of action has accrued under Garner, because he doesn't know whether the evidence he would attack with a Fourth Amendment claim is going to turn out to be critical to the prosecution.
Of all the cases that you think Gauger now calls into question, which would you think is most called into question? Would it be Booker?
It's so close between Booker and Washington and Gonzalez. I hate to pick. If I'm forced to pick Judge Rovner, I will probably pick Booker. But we think, you know, Judge Mannion wrote an opinion in Copas, where Judge Mannion evidently misunderstood the law in this circuit, according to Judge Posner, because Judge Mannion wrote in Posner.
Very possible.
Well, we like what you said, Judge Mannion, in Copas, because he
makes it more possible, doesn't it?
Well, I regret if that's the case, Judge Mannion. There are finally important policy issues that are at stake here. Cases, especially this kind of litigation, should be initiated promptly before memories fade. Police officers make dozens and dozens of arrests each year. If cases don't need to be filed until criminal proceedings are over and then another 2 years elapse, generally the police officer, the only truthful testimony he can give is, I don't remember what happened. If the case is promptly brought, memories can be preserved, an investigation can be promptly commenced. The federal civil rights case perhaps should be stayed if there is some risk that it will interfere with an ongoing prosecution. But there is every reason to enforce the policy here, encouraging the prompt bringing of claims. State law, on the other hand, provides plaintiffs with a full malicious prosecution action if they are indeed seeking damages for the course of a prosecution. They can bring those cases after the prosecution is over, and state law provides a remedy. But the kinds of stale claims that will result if the accrual rule of Gauger is followed should be resisted. And for those reasons, we do respectfully request that the court affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. You've got a few minutes, 4 minutes, Mr. Franklin.
Let me start out by referring the court to the record. Plaintiff's memorandum in opposition to motion to dismiss footnote 1, in which plaintiff says that there's no malicious prosecution claim in this complaint. We don't raise one. And the city's request to dismiss the non-asserted claim should be rejected. We didn't allege a malicious prosecution claim, no matter how vigorously it's urged upon this court. The question of whether Gauger is consistent with Booker is a fascinating question, and I'd love to have half an hour to debate it if I was representing a client who cared about the outcome of that distinction. If I was re-arguing Mr. Booker, and I think there are two members of the panel, maybe we could redo it again, I would be interested in doing that. But Mr. Wiley doesn't care about how that issue of law is decided. Mr. Wiley cares about his frame-up claim. Heck, in addition to what Mr. was described as a confusing footnote, changed the law in this circuit and said that if you're a civil rights plaintiff and you're bringing a lawsuit that says I was improperly convicted because the police lied or the police fabricated evidence, you can't bring that case until the criminal case is over.
If we did reinstate Mr. Wiley's Fourth Amendment claim, the scope of that claim would be defined by Gauger, and it would then would it not be limited to the harm that he incurred from the false arrest before he was charged?
The scope from the arrest is limited by Gauger, which actually was the rule applied by the district court in Booker, which is the rule set out in Heck. But in this case, unlike Gauger, there are other Fourth Amendment claims that are asserted. We say that there's a new Fourth Amendment violation when at the Gerstein determination, there was a bogus determination of probable cause based on the frame of the fabricated evidence. We say that there's another Fourth Amendment violation when the grand jury, based upon the perjured testimony of the complaining witness, the cop, said, we're going to indict you. And those claims were not asserted in Gauger. The opinion is clear that the plaintiff is not raising any Fourth Amendment claims, and is not raising...
Well, how long are the damages? In Garger, it says that the damage will be limited to the harm that he incurred from the false arrest before he was... that he incurred from the false arrest before he was charged, which isn't a very long time. You seem to say as long as some taint of this lie prevailed, that it's the damage time.
I'm saying that there are other claims that are asserted by the plaintiff in this case, in addition to being arrested based on fabricated evidence. And I think there's another case, I don't remember the name of, where Your Honor was on the panel, where the court talked about post-arrest misconduct of a police officer giving rise to other cases. It was a case from Springfield, which is the name of which
that's
escapes
me. Natterly?
No.
Well, never mind. Don't worry about it.
The case is called McCullough versus Gutierrez.
Oh, McCullough. Okay.
And that case, is we're talking, the other claims asserted in this case are the McCullough claims of post-arrest, making the false report, which was used by, relied upon by the judge making the Gerson determination, testifying falsely at the preliminary hearing, which is not actionable because there was a final probable cause, testifying falsely at the grand jury, which is actionable. Those are the claims that are asserted here that were not asserted in McCullough. And if there's a case where the McCullough issue, or the Gutierrez issue, is asserted, I would love to argue that in bank, but it's not asserted in this case. This is not a case like Booker where an arrest is made and it turns out a state court says the arrest is not based on probable cause. This is a case where an arrest is made, the cop says, you don't have anything, and then he plants drugs on the guy and makes up the case. This is a frame-up case. It's not a mistaken arrest case. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.